Welcome to the Full of Tracy Monday Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 3:20 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is September 12th. Well, tomorrow is CPI day, and the CPI right now is at 8.5%, and it's down a bit since the peak in June. Now, the big question, of course, is it going to fall a lot, or could it potentially even rise? Well, at least oil prices are still coming down, so. I think this is something that's going to move the headline figure, because this would we could just think about that the daily average price of gasoline peaked in June, and since then it has fallen from about $5 to $3.70. So that's a big move. It's probably going to contribute to CPI figures coming down, but I think what most people are going to be focusing on is the core rate. And the core rate is going to be much more influenced by housing prices and used vehicles. So housing doesn't get updated all that often, but used vehicles have been coming down since the beginning of this year. And it was updated at the end of last month and down a bit. So this does look like it's peaked. And if we just look at as much history as we have available, hopefully it goes back before 2016, we can see that we had a pop on the upside in 2017, but there's never been anything like this before. So this isn't something, this is much more likely to be an aberration. Except for the fact, well, I guess the easiest conclusion is that it's an aberration. But there is, of course, the other side of this equation, which is supply. And a lot of the automotive companies have decided that they're not going to hold inventory, that they're going to make sure that they're going to start running more like just-in-time inventory for the supply of vehicles, instead of running just in time for manufacturing. They're going to try and run just in time for supply, and they're going to concentrate on electric vehicles, and they're going to use the subsidies they get from those electric vehicles then to build SUVs. So what it's going to contribute to is the average price of the a vehicle rising, and that's not going to improve the supply of affordable cars. That's a real threat. It's not baked in the cake just yet, but it is certainly a potential outcome. And that is the kind of thing that could contribute to higher inflation for longer. Then, of course, we have to just bear in mind that a lot of what's been happening is very much tied to the quantity of money that's been printed. So, when we think about the reserves that are being held by banks in the Federal Reserve, and we look at that relative to GDP, and we're going to get an interesting figure. Because one thing that I found really interesting about what Jay Powell had to say back in June was, first he said, and it was almost like a slip of the tongue. And I'm going to just think of that in Freudian terms. He first said that they were going to shave between 2 and 3 trillion off the size of the Fed's balance sheet. Now, that's a lot. But then he corrected himself and said that what they're really looking at is the size of the balance sheet relative to GDP. So what we really then need to do is to find the best way of measuring the size of the Fed's balance sheet. So one way to do that is to look at the reserves held at the Fed by constituent banks and plot that relative to GDP, which is what we have right here. So I thought, and I do think that this is one of the things that the Fed looks at, because what we can see is that from 2014 to 2019, this chart went down, and the percentage of the Fed's balance sheet relative to GDP went from about 16 or 0.16 to about 0.63. So that's significant. So even though they were engaged in quantitative tightening in 2018 and 19, and that's when we saw this acceleration. And at before that, they were holding policy steady, but the economy was expanding. So their view is that they were in fact tightening all the way through 2014 to 19. Then, of course, that tightening was completely replaced by the quantity of money printed in 2020 and 2021. Now, the tightening that's taken place since the latter portion of 2021 has basically unwound everything that took place in 2021. But the big splurge of activity in 2020 has not been fully unwound. So what we might just then think about is the Fed might be about halfway to its goal of removing liquidity. So that's why people think that the potential is that and I'm going to put up this ratio. This is the Fed's balance sheet relative to GDP. It's got different figures, but it's pretty much the same chart. And that's it, but I think this is the way that people are thinking about the potential for the Fed to stop raising rates and begin to start cutting as soon as the first quarter of 2023. So if you did believe that, then looking at the S&P 500, this would be a higher reaction low. And we've had 4 consecutive days on the upside. And this market is back testing the region of the 200-day moving average. So we've had a significant pullback into the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and we've had a rebound. Then we've had a consolidation, and this looks like a higher reaction low. And in just very simple chart reading, that is a bullish signal. So this, at least, as long as the low that was put in last week is holding, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside in the short term. But this is one of the biggest challenges that we have when reading charts, and it is simply by looking only at one chart, reaching one conclusion, and looking at lots, we might reach a different one. And then also looking at credit conditions, because there are two important factors in any trend. The first is crowd psychology and the enthusiasm of the market, and the second is the availability of liquidity. Now, we have inverted yield curves, and the 10-year minus the 2-year is around negative 21 basis points, and it's been inverted now for nearly 3 months, and the longer it stays inverted for, the more likely it is that it's going to be a reliable lead indicator for a recession. As soon as it becomes inverted, then the clock starts ticking on when the recession starts, and it could be anything from 6 months to 18 months. So we're about 3 months in. Well, then you'd have to bet that there's going to be a recession in 2023. Now let's look at the 10-year minus the 3-month, because it looks quite different. We had a really big surge in the spread in the early part of this year. So this spread was going in the opposite direction of the 10-year minus the 2-year. And there's a good reason for that. It's because there was massive selling pressure at the long end of the curve, and anyone who had to hold bonds, they shortened up their duration as much as they possibly could. So that deflated the 3-month yield, inflated the 10-year yield, and created a wide spread. But now that the Fed is hiking rates aggressively, well, then the 3-month has started to rise, and rise faster than the 10-year. So we've had this contraction, and this is a whopping contraction, coming from 2.25 to about 30 basis points. So nearly 200 basis points of tightening in the space of only about 3 or 4 months. Now let's zoom in a little, because it looks like this spread might have paused, but there is obviously the potential that it's going to contract further if the Federal Reserve goes ahead and continues to raise rates. So we're at a very interesting juncture. If they decide to stop raising rates and they are more worried about a recession, then the potential is that corporate profits could at least stabilize and growth might slow, but we might not get a recession. But of course, if they do, but of course, then if we don't get a recession, the inflationary pressures that have been unleashed in the economy will continue. And that's where the wage price spiral argument starts to become more pressing. On the other hand, if they do whatever is necessary to contain inflation now, then there's at least the potential that they might succeed. We'll then almost certainly have a recession, but it would forestall the potential that inflation is going to become entrenched. So the Fed has a rather difficult decision. It's either pain in the short term for a long-term gain, or less pain in the short term, but long-term problems. So investors are willing to bet that the Fed is coming close to the end of its interest rate hiking policy. And the dollar has been selling off for 4 days in a row. Now, I think it's particularly relevant here. 4 days on the downside for the dollar. 4 days on the upside for Wall Street. 4 days on the upside for gold. Silver today was up a dollar. And we're definitely seeing quite a few trends reversing. And silver rebounding now emphatically here from under the $18 level. So at least beginning to demonstrate some support coming through here in the upper side of the base formation. Certainly got a lot of work to do, and I think a lot of people will be a lot happier if silver can sustain a move back above the $20 level. And platinum prices, and certainly being aided by some enthusiasm for hydrogen, platinum continues to rebound and is coming back up towards the succession of lower rally highs, the 200-day moving average, and the psychological $1,000 level. So we've got some really big psychological resistance not all that far away from where prices are right now. Of course, if it can sustain moves above that big $1,000 level, then we're back in a bull market environment. Now let's think about what's going on in Europe. Sweden's election just came through, and it's a right-wing, populist, anti-cohesion, nationalistic party looks to be the kingmaker in that election. The stock market is steadying, and the euro is also beginning to steady here. So the ECB is raising rates, and we've had a steadier euro, but not able to hold on to the rally on Friday and not able to hold on to the rally in here today either. This isn't really convincing rebound kind of activity. And there's still clearly a sequence of lower rally highs. I think the big outstanding question isn't about whether the euro can persist or not. It's about how much of a sacrifice are the Germans, Dutch, Austrians, and Finnish and going to or are willing to make in order to rescue the currency. Because Europeans have had a tough time of it. The euro was created in the early 2000s. China joined the WTO in the year 2000. So at exactly the same time that the euro provided at Germany's interest rates to the entire eurozone, the domestic low-end manufacturing sector was eviscerated, and particularly on the periphery. I know, for example, when I was growing up, in my hometown, there was a shoe factory My uncle worked in a shoe factory. My father worked in a hosiery factory. And it's a tourist town, so there's lots of hotels. Today, there's still a crane factory in the town. So, of those three big employers that were outside of the tourist industry, two of them are now gone. And that shoe factory, now they were producing shoes that were not very comfortable. And as children, none of us wanted to wear them. And that's a good reason why they probably went bust. But the domestic shoe manufacturing business went, or basically failed to exist in France, Spain, and Italy around the early 2000s. Leather working was completely moved offshore. What's happened in the aftermath of the credit crisis is that it was Chinese manufacturers bought Italian labels. The goods are manufactured in China, exported to Italy. The finishing of that product is done in Italy, and then they're re-exported. That is exactly the same thing that happened with all the furniture businesses. A lot of Italian furniture is manufactured in China or India or Indonesia, sent to Italy, basically repackaged and finished, and then sent off somewhere else. So that kind of evisceration of manufacturing was papered over by the availability of cheap credit and the building boom, and it created a wealth effect. So the populist movement did not grow and prosper, and the anti-cohesion movement was practically non-existent until the sovereign wealth crisis, over a decade after the creation of the euro. Now we have the ill effects of the enforced fiscal cohesion having already spurred the anti-cohesion movement everywhere in the EU. We have the failed energy policies that have been deployed, resulting in huge inflationary pressures and massive threats to living standards. And Europe is justifiably being blamed. So it's very reasonable to anticipate that there will be a surge of anti-cohesion activity, because the number one resort of a local politician will be to blame the EU for the malaise at the local level. And that's likely to result in a lot of electoral gains for populist movements. And we haven't even begun winter yet. But I was reading over the weekend that a polar vortex is already forming over the North Pole. And the EU's own weather body believes that the Tonga earthquake, with the massive movement of water vapor into the stratosphere, created a cold environment in the southern hemisphere and will probably do the same thing for the northern hemisphere. So, natural gas prices have been easing back in Europe, and the Dutch benchmark was at a new closing low in here today. So, at least some of the exaggerated buying activity that was seen in August is beginning to ebb. But that doesn't get over the real challenge of ensuring that there's enough of energy for Europe for this winter. And it's very likely that there's going to be energy rationing, and that's not good news for the corporate sector. So there's going to have to be massive money printing in order to shore up domestic economies. Well, massive money printing generally is rewarded in the stock market. So the Euro Stoxx index has not been falling as aggressively as it might. All of the pressure is being experienced in the currency. So we have the succession of lower rally highs, and we have now got a higher reaction low, So there's the potential now that this is a wedging characteristic, and it could potentially pop on the upside in local currency terms. We redenominate the euro stocks into dollars. Well, then the size of the pullback, I think, is much more clear, and we have a very clear succession of ranges, one below the last. So then we can think about the pound, and it was also in positive territory in here today and did a better job of holding on to its gains. Of course, the UK is now outside the EU and is not as dependent on Russian exports as Europe is, and has had a more ambivalent attitude towards Russia for the last few years, and therefore is a little bit more insulated from the threat. This news over the weekend that Russia has lost some ground in Ukraine is obviously a positive development for Ukraine. Now, the question, of course, is, are they going to become overextended, and will Russia be able to pull off a pincer movement? That's obviously the risk, and I'm sure that the Ukrainians are aware of that. The next question, of course, is if Russia is losing ground and becomes desperate, will then their actions become more desperate? Because we've also seen in here today that they are attacking utilities inside Ukraine well beyond the front line. So there is retribution being meted upon civilian targets within Ukraine. And there's obviously the potential that that could escalate. Now, when we think about the pound, though, it's been really quite consistent on the downside, and it was overextended. So we're getting at least some pause and consolidation. But it's at a minimum going to have to sustain a move above 120 in order to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. What was particularly interesting in here today is that the yen could not rally, and the dollar was a little bit steadier against it. And that's against a background where the dollar was weak against most currencies. Brazilian CPI peaked in April, and the currency is now firming again back towards this five level. There's been a succession of lower rally highs for the dollar since the middle of 2020. And I think it was Unibanco was estimating today that CPI will be back around 6% by the first quarter of next year. But the Selic interest rate, target rate, is at 13.75%, which is about where it was back in 2015 and 16. But this is world-beating interest rates. And the one thing that we have in Brazil today are positive real interest rates. And we should contrast that with the difficulty that the Bank of England is having in raising rates. The Bank of England's rate is at 1.75%, and CPI is running in excess of 10%. And there's just no prospect that they're going to raise rates by another 9% to get a positive real interest rate. So there's obviously the potential that the UK is beholden to the wider market, and the willingness of politicians not to just continue spending money they don't have in order to try and get inflation down. So Brazil, because the political environment is essentially dysfunctional, the central bank gladly has independence and has been taking matters into its own hands, and they've been raising rates aggressively. So there is at least the potential that it's Brazil is going to start to be able to attract capital. It's got the higher rates. The currency adjusted ETF is bouncing from the lower side of its range, and consumer demand is likely to improve as the interest rate environment stabilizes. So the financial sector and fintech companies within Brazil are likely to do better. And PagSeguro is coming back up towards the upper side of its base formation. And the interesting thing about fintechs is that PagSeguro is an interesting example of where the financial technology type companies have advantages. It has about 9% of the financial sector, and it's running at a much more profitable environment because it doesn't have to sustain the branch network. And over time, as a younger generation becomes more, or I guess, as people spend more time on their phones and expect to be able to do everything that they need to do on their phone, well, then the whole expense of maintaining a branch network becomes less compelling. So these online companies are probably going to capture market share because they'll be able to offer products at a cheaper level. In the UK, you have Revolut, which is the same sort of business model, but it's not a listed company. It's inevitable, though, that these fintech companies will become investable eventually. Now, the ARK Innovation ETF, it tends to, or the FinTech Innovation ETF marries together some of the cryptocurrencies and these conventional type of fintech operations, and it collapsed at the beginning of this year. But it is exhibiting some base formation characteristics in just the same way that lower interest rates and more credit availability in Brazil should support the banking sector, then that should also be the case for the fintech sector when the Fed eventually does begin to lower interest rates and make money available. And then you have the potential for higher growth companies and higher growth countries to continue to gain relative strength. So in dollar terms, the Nifty index in the US, in India is pushing on the upside and firming from the region of the 200-day moving average. In local currency terms, it's on the cusp of pushing out and breaking the sequence of lower rally highs. And the Indian rupee has been reasonably steady. It's at least pausing over the course of the last 6 weeks. So we have the potential for some sectors to attract more interest as the global investors, I guess, begin to weigh up where are the potential growth strategies and success stories likely to come from. And biotech is also starting to attract more interest. You have President Biden today talking about a moonshot for cancer therapy. That's certainly starting to attract more interest for biotech. The NASDAQ Biotech Index has got an inverted head and shoulders, which does look like support building or bottoming activity. And some of these smaller companies in immuno-oncology are starting to rebound again. So Clovis Oncology was up in an impressive manner in here today and bouncing and putting in a higher reaction low from the $1 level. Bluebird Bio is also in the same category and bouncing as well. So this looks like a little first step above the base. And we're talking about shares that have really come down awfully hard over the last few years. But with more government support and a shorter runway to commercialization, then they are doing better. Then in the large cap pharmaceutical sector, Bristol Myers Squibb is coming up to the, or is attempting to hold the breakout from what's basically a 6-year range. And it popped on the upside today on the approval of its psoriasis drug. It wasn't quite able to hold all of the move, but this continues to look like a consolidation in the region of the all-time peaks. Now let's think about the cloud computing sector. So we're definitely seeing some support building activity, but it's still below the 1,000-day and 200-day moving averages. So this is still a distribution until proven otherwise. The big challenge here is that there are definitely portions of the market had an awful lot of good news priced in and thrived during the pandemic and pulled forward growth from the future. So we've certainly seen that with cloud computing. Now, these companies, many of them, are still growing at an impressive rate, but that doesn't mean that they're going to be able to sustain the growth rate indefinitely. Amazon was in positive territory in here today, and it has put in a higher reaction low now, and it's bouncing from the 1,000-day moving average. Well, this is the biggest of the cloud companies with Amazon Web Services, and if it can hold the low, then that's going to be encouraging. So we're really at a delicate situation. If the Fed decides to start tapering its interest rate hikes and begins to intimate that the balance sheet runoff is more than half done and will be done by the end of the year, then I think there's potential for the markets to rebound. On the other hand, if they continue to signal that we're going to have outsized interest rate hikes to get in control of inflation today, well, then these rebounds are not going to hold. So, and then of course we do have this background of the inverted yield curves, which is a very reliable lead indicator for recessions, and then we have the high yield spreads, which are still around 500 basis points. And we'll have to at least break the sequence of higher reaction lows to signal that we have a peak of more than very short-term significance. The VIX index was actually in positive territory today. So it's been coming down for most of last week, but we still have an incremental sequence of higher reaction lows over the course of the last year. And it would need to sustain a move down below 20 to really reignite demand dominance. There's been a lot of shorting going on over the course of the last few months. There's a lot of demand for hedging because of the uncertainty about the interest rate environment, and that has fueled a short covering rally in stocks. But we'll need some fundamentals to start to fill in behind that if these rebounds are to be sustained. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.